Blog Talk Radio.
Let's go. Yeah. Ghetto children singing. See, what up? They eager to learn how to become the next world leaders. Brave hearts, huh? Revolutionary warfare is all fair, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is all fair, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Book one, strategy, tactics, techniques. Look dumb, but massively notice the weakness in all them. Gotta use it only if necessary. Homie, investors is very real if enemies carrying heavy steel. Beware the thugs who ain't scared of blood or jail time. When Aryan nations ain't having integration, we so blind, the beauty of life was when my mom said, if you could be Christ, I wasn't old enough to hold my MP right. Jesus, what is he like? I picture him standing with diamonds on him, little different from the way my mommy saw him. Practice your aiming, physical training in difficult terraining. Test your endurance, try to keep your stamina. Banging, splitting duchess up, strap up. The army's a school, teaching smart ways to go. I'm thinking Gandhi was a fool, the chronic's a fool. Got me thinking out loud. Sleep on my drunkenness, I blow your brains out. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
My revolution is as real as Bobby Seals. I build with dudes and Chris worth a quarter mil and Dick Hill. For fish gills and cops, when the time come, I mask up and get my comrade off the bus. Up the beef, I snatch a seed from Chuck E. Cheese and feed them to the rats in the back of the peas. Black fatigue and off the scenes on a sofa. 50-inch flat screen, Louis Vuitton holster. My motions don't appeal to appellate division. I did it strong for 7 long years in prison. Of the system, I'm like a modern-day Hitler. Black gorilla, crib and blood in one only. Just know my face, I be the case for the wish at the police. They'll get the name Lake. Go simultaneously with street revolution. 21 gun salute, the new Huey Newton.
Revolutionary warfare is warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Teach our woman how to hold a family down in case something happens to us fathers. Protect the children, grab revolvers. The woman plays an important part of our life force. So what we fight for, my heart goes to you, beautiful wife in war.
Enlist in more and talk less. Watch all and trust none. Demand your respect and be ready to die for what you believe in. And ride all the time, not just when convenient.
Justice and freedom, wisdom and understanding. We the lost children of Israel in this Western world region. You ain't a man, you a coward if you can't support the girl you put a seed in.
Strong rule the weak, but the wise rule is strong. It's more to a war than just getting it on. Seal your form, cover your tracks, stay prepared. I don't care, no one's spared.
Revolutionary warfare is warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer.
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over!
Mr. Jackson, I'm sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see to that.
with Eric's.
Starring Gary Dordan from TVCSI.
This is the military, David.
Free the land. Revolutionary Greetings. Welcome to another edition of Georgia University Radio, where our goal is a fivefold. Our first goal is to eradicate functional literacy among new African black prisoners. Two, to eradicate cultural ignorance among new African prisoners. Three, to transform the criminal mentality to the new African mentality. Four, to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of the new African cities, communities. Five, prepare new African prisoners for release, reducing new African recidivism. I'm your host, Bumani Shakir. Before I bring on the guests, I'll let you share a couple of events that happened this week during the history. On May the 22nd, in 1960, the Associated Press reported that more than 1,000 blacks had been arrested in sit-down demonstrations. Also, on March 22nd, 1965, the civil rights march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. Also, on March 22nd, 1968, through the 22nd through the 24th, state troopers mobilized to put down student rebellion on campus of Chardonnay State College. Also, on March 22nd, 2020, we lost Dr. Layla Africa, which is a known scholar, historian, author, highly self doctor at the age of 24. On March 23rd, 1942, Walter Rodney, who's an author, historian, revolutionary, born 1942. 1985, March 23rd, Patricia Robert Harris, the first black woman ambassador and the first black woman cabinet member, died in Washington at the age of 60. On March 24th, Blacks gained right to vote in Canada in 1837. Also on March 24, 1871, President Grant issued a proclamation against the Ku Klux Klan terrorism in South Carolina. On today, on March 25th, in 1910, Liberian Commission recommended financial aid to Liberia and the establishment of a U.S. Navy coaling station in an African country. Also today, in 1931, Ida B. Wells Barnett, who was an editor, protest leader, and founder of the anti-lynching movement, died in Chicago at the age of 68. She also was a co-founder of NAACP, National Advanced Association for Colored People. Also on this day, in 1977, in New Jersey, Mama Sai Secure convicted of murder and sentenced to life plus 33 years in prison. She was liberated in 1979, and she's still a similar reason to this day. Also today, in 1977, Shirley Brown Du Bois, author and widow of Dr. W. Du Bois, died in Peking, China at the age of 69. And also today, we lost a prominent person in our African history, a scholar, historian, a storyteller, a philosopher, writer. We lost the great Kreda Mutwa, who was a Zulu shaman. Okay, on March 26, 1831, Richard Allen, who was nominated by Arthur Vernon Loggins for the title of Father of the Negro, died in Philadelphia at age 72. Richard Allen also was one of the ones responsible for the AME, African Message Peace Park Zion Church. He also was three African side. He also was a Prince Hall Mason at that time, known as the Black Masons. Okay, also on the 26th, 1872, Thomas J. Martin of Vienna awarded patent for the fire extinguisher. Also on March 26, 1911, William H. Lewis appointed Assistant Attorney General of the United States. Also on March 26, 1937, William H. Hastie confirmed as judge of federal district court in Virgin Islands and became the first black federal judge. Okay, on March 27, 1867, black demonstrators in Charleston staged riot-ins on streetcars. 1867, black demonstrators in Charleston staged rioting on streetcars on May the 3rd at the Charleston City Railroad Company. On May the 3rd, the Charleston City Railroad Company adopted a resolution guaranteeing the right of all persons to ride in streetcars. Also, on March 27, 1969, the Black Academy of Arts letter was founded at a Boston meeting by leading African American artists and intellectuals. Dr. C. Eric Lincoln, professor of religion and sociology at Union Theological Seminary, was elected president of the organization. also on March 27, 1972, two surviving Soledad brothers, Fleto Drongo and John Cliche, was acquitted by an all-white jury of charging that he killed a white guard at the Soledad from 1970. We know that August 21, 1971, Comrade George Jackson was assassinated. Okay, also on March 27, in 1972, Angola, Africa, successfully forced the invaded South African army out of Angolia. On March 28, 1887, James M. Trotter of Boston, named recorder of deeds by Democratic President Grover Cleveland. Also on 1867, on March 28, Sandy Black reported lynching. Also on that date, Florida AME University and Central State College were established. Also on March 28, 1968, a race riot in Memphis, Tennessee, interrupted a protest march led by Dr. Martin Luther King in support of striking sanitation workers. The National Guard were called up. And we know that the following month, on April, he was assassinated. Okay, also on March 28, 1984, Benjamin E. Mays, a minister, educator, and civil rights leader, who served as president of Morehead College for 27 years, died in Atlanta at the age of 89. We know a lot of other things happening in history this week, but I would like to bring onto this show Mama Nikisha Taifa. Free to Lamb, Mama, how you doing?
How are you, Free to Lamb, my brother? I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. I'm pushing and moving.
It was great
wonderful.
Hearing about all those things that happened during this week in March. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Oh, true indeed. True indeed. No problem. Okay, before we start, can you tell the people a little about yourself, who you are, especially in regards to you being a business owner? Tell the people about yourself.
A business owner? Okay. I wear a lot of hats, my brother. I'm surprised that's the hat you decided to put on my head tonight. But I'm Nikisha Taifa. I'm a long-distance runner, I guess you could say. I've been around quite a while. I will just say I have a book coming out, a memoir called Power Black Lawyer, which basically tells the story of a young woman growing up during the era of the 70s and early 80s, what I call Black Power era, and the social justice lawyer she became. Okay, so I guess my roots really start back to, I guess, eighth grade, shall I say, seeing a poster on my eighth grade Black History classroom. This was during the time when Black History was first coming into the schools, and there was this picture with this Black man with a Black beret on his head, with a rifle in one hand and a spear in the other, sitting in a Grand Slam wicker chair. And all the girls in my class, little teenagers, were talking about how fine this brother was. And I was asking the teacher, well, you know, why is he being represented by white lawyers? I was asking him, where are the Black lawyers to represent the Black people? And, of course, that was Huey Newton, the chair of the Black Panther Party, at that particular time. And that question just kind of gnawed me throughout. Where were the Black lawyers to represent the white people? True, he was represented by radical lawyers and political lawyers, but again, where were the Black lawyers? And from that, and then from earlier when I saw that picture of Emmett Till in this book that was in my parents' den called Public Safety Alert just came across my phone. I don't know what it was. But anyway, the Emmett Till, the murder of Emmett Till, it just left a great impact on me, I guess you could say, that I wanted to do something about all of these things. So I always kind of wanted to be a lawyer. But long before I became a lawyer, I became involved in revolutionary movements, I guess you could say, and activism, and studied at the feet of some of the most iconic yet unheralded leaders, such as Brother Imari Abubakar Yobadeli, such as Brother Attorney Chokwe Lumumba, you know, such as Queen Mother Artley Moore. I mean, you know, the list goes on. And, you know, these folk had a great impact on me. Reverend Ishaka Musa Barashango was right here in Washington, D.C., and I learned at their feet, and I studied, and I became part of the movement. So So I'm going to just stop right there. Later I became a lawyer, and that's kind of what I'm doing today.
Okay. I understand you're the president and CEO of the Taifa Group, right? What does the Taifa Group specialize in? What do y'all actually do?
Yeah, so the Taifa Group is a social justice firm whose mission is to advance justice. We do consulting in all areas of the justice system. I've been working in this area of criminal justice reform and transformation for over 30 plus years, if not more. And I decided to branch out on my own after working for other people, I guess you could say, for many, many years. And try to provide some services to the community myself, primarily in the area of consulting, whether it is I convene a major coalition called the Justice Roundtable, which has over 100 organizations working on federal criminal justice policy reform issues. But I do a lot of other things as well. A lot of it is convening. A lot of it is helping infrastructure building and things along those lines, government relations and the like. And right now it's like with the crisis that's going on in this country right now, you know, they say when America catches a cold, black folk, you know, got the flu. Well, we got the pandemic right now, and many of our people are languishing, very vulnerable populations inside the prisons in this country. No one had been paying attention to this, but we sought with our coalition to try to put this issue on the map and work with a lot of different people and organizations and directly impacted people and formerly incarcerated people, and we're kind of like 24/7 around the clock trying to impact on Congress and their staffers and the executive branch and the like, the critical importance of dealing with this population, because no matter how much money they throw at the stimulus, if we're not dealing with what is at ground zero, which is inside our punitive institutions, then it's basically it's going to end up being game over, not just for them, but for people on the outside as well. So those are the things that I'm doing and engaged in, you know, right now.
Okay. I understand that you passed a lot of legislation, such as the Second Chance Act Reentry, the First Step Act, and the Way of the Fair Sitting Act, correct, disparaging legislation. Can you tell me about the old particular acts and why you pushed to establish those?
Okay, so I'm going to first talk about crack, if I can, because you're talking about a long-distance, long-time struggle. Nothing happens overnight up here in Washington. And basically, way back in the early 90s, when I was working for the American Civil Liberties Union Washington office, I started working on the crack versus powder cocaine. The crack just issued the 100-to-1 quantity ratio between crack and powder cocaine. And this was during a time when no one was focused on this issue. This was during a time when the issue of racial profiling was not a term of art. This was during a time when we had to really bring the NAACP kicking and screaming into anything dealing with criminal justice unless we were talking about racism in the application of the death penalty. This was during the time when omnibus crime bills were being crafted in a Congress, resulting in the what I call the granddaddy of all the crime bills, which resulted in being the crime bill in 1994, which had the largest expansion of the federal death penalty in modern times. It had the federal three strikes laws. It had the gutting of habeas corpus, the evisceration of the exclusionary rule. It had trying 13-year-olds as adults. It had the elimination of Pell educational grants in a prison, and it had more and more money to states to build more and more prisons to keep people in prison for longer and longer periods of time. No abatement to mandatory minimum sentences, no fix to the crack powder disparities. This was a time during the early 90s when I was walking the halls of Congress trying to shed a light on these issues. This is what ushered in the era of which we are in now, the era of mass incarceration. And this was under a Democratic administration. We all know the story when President Clinton actually left the campaign trail to oversee the execution of a mentally challenged person in his home state of Arkansas. So those were the times we were living in. So it was right around that time when the United States Sentencing Commission was beginning to look at this disparity between crack and powder cocaine. And I decided to focus on that this issue, even though I knew nothing about it at the time. There were no newspaper articles hardly on it. There was nothing, no law review articles. Nobody was talking about it. I found one little article in USA Today that was talking about the disparity. And I had to educate myself because the only thing out there was, you know, young black men getting thrown up against the cars by police, and nobody was, everybody thought that all this was because blacks were using all this crack, blah, blah, blah. But the research, my brother, I found was that there were more whites using crack than blacks. It was just the enforcement was disproportionately focused on inner city black communities, and that is what resulted with these overwhelming numbers of black people, primarily black men, in prison under this legislation, which gave them much, much, much longer periods of time. So we organized coalitions. We talked to the media. We got Congressman Rangel to introduce a bill. We did all of these things. This was during the early to mid-90s. But it wasn't until 2010 that the law was actually changed. The 101 ratio was lessened to 18 to 1. I tell about all of that congressional sausage making, I guess you could say, in my memoir coming out, Black Power, Black Lawyer. But we did receive a partial victory. But the problem was, my brother, it wasn't made retroactive, which means everyone who was already in prison since the 80s and 90s and 2000s with these unfair, unjust crack cocaine sentences didn't benefit from the change of the law. It only related to new people. It wasn't until the end of 2018 that the provision was made retroactive. So that was a long, long struggle. Now, in the interim of that, in 2008, the Second Chance Reentry Bill passed. We started working on that bill really in 2002 when I went to the Open Society Foundations. Again, we formed the Coalition Justice Roundtable, which, again, sought to humanize the issue of just who it was who was in prison. We brought people to Capitol Hill. Kimber Smith, who we call the poster child, who had recently gotten out of prison with her sentence was commuted at the end of Clinton's term. A college student, Kimber Smith, you know, got caught up, you know, with her boyfriend's drug conspiracy. First time nonviolent drug offender, sentenced to 24 and a half years in prison. So we brought her up to Capitol Hill. We highlighted stories like Clarence Aaron, who was still sitting in prison at that time, and talking about the extreme disparities that these were not people that needed to be warehoused away, that something was wrong with the system, not anything wrong with the people. And we would end up getting the Second Chance Act passed for reentry to be able to provide resources for people coming home. It was very deficient, though, because it didn't deal with a lot of what I call the collateral consequences of conviction, didn't really deal with the education, didn't really deal with the housing, didn't really deal with the economics, didn't really deal with a lot of these issues that people face when they come home, but it did serve to highlight the issues and give money to states and to organizations to start to do something about it. And then finally, the First Step Act, which passed at the end of 2018, I hate the term First Step Act, because we have so many first steps. I mean, it's just getting ridiculous. All the things I've been talking about before were all first steps. So why call this bill, now that's a baby step. But what we were able to do finally was to get that retroactivity of the crack disparity into that bill, along with some other things, some strengthening of compassionate release, some of the things we're trying to do now with this COVID-19 virus and the impact in the communities. And then finally, we also work closely with the Obama administration on his clemency initiatives, which resulted in the release from unjust incarceration of over 1,700 people. And again, I talk about all of these things in my upcoming memoir, Black Power, Black Lawyer. But the struggle continues because there's so much that needs to be done. One of the things we were successful in doing was helping to move the minds and hearts of people from the tough-on-crime mentality from the 90s to a little bit more what I'm calling the smart on justice, shall we say, that people are dealing with today, even though all that seems to be going out the door now with this pandemic. But, you know, the struggle continues, as I said.
True indeed. Okay. Now, I'd like to ask you, by being an attorney, can you tell us what laws in particular that pertain to New African people, and how can they, a.k.a. black people, how can they be utilized in the modern-day society? What are some of the most important laws?
All right. So I'm going to go into my revolutionary black power hat right now, if I may, since this is the George Jackson Radio, because one law you rarely hear anything about, and we rarely hear the analogy of that law applying to black people here in this country. But it is a law that was signed into existence by the United States, yet we rarely see it being used in court. And that law is an international convention called the International Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. I want to repeat that. The International Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. That was signed by the United States. It was ratified by the Senate. It was passed into law by the Congress. But what separates the Genocide Convention from all of the other international human rights conventions is that it's actionable in U.S. law. There is implementing legislation. You don't have that with the Race Convention. You don't have that with the Torture Convention. You don't have that with the Women's Convention. But you do have it with the Genocide Convention. So why are we not using it? I would say one thing. Most of us don't realize what the international definition of genocide is, which has been adopted in U.S. law. It's not just as kind of learned growing up in school, killing off all the Indians or burning the Jews in the oven. No. The definition of genocide, which is actionable in U.S. courts, is, number one, killing members of a group. Number two, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of a group. Number three, deliberately inflicting upon the group conditions of life calculated to bring about the destruction in whole or in part. And it goes on with several other definitions. That's what the international definition is. But it goes even further, my brother Bomani. It says that genocide is not the only actionable act. Conspiracy to commit genocide, direct and public incitement to commit genocide, attempt to commit genocide, and complicity in its commission. And it goes even further. It says that those guilty of genocide shall be punished, regardless of whether they are constitutionally protected ruler, Donald Trump, regardless of whether they are public officials or whether they are private citizens. That's the law right there. We don't learn about that in school. I surely didn't learn about it in law school. In fact, in law school was when these things, when I was in law school, were just being passed and all like that. Now, there are some people who try to use this. People like Mario Badelli, Chokwe Lumumba, use these arguments as part of the defense of the Mutulu Shakur case. I know I did legal work for Brother Chokwe during that time. We did a brief. And in fact, in that brief, Shakur, Merlin Buck and Mutulu Shakur, B.U.S., U.S.B., whatever, Charles Haight, H-A-I-G-H-T, who was the judge, actually required the Department of Justice, the Department of Defense, the Department of several other different war departments in the United States to respond to our legal arguments. Okay? This way, for those who are legal eagles or lawyers out there, there's a reported case out there. If you look at U.S. v. Buck or U.S. v. Mutulu Shakur, look up Nate Chokwe Lumumba, Nikichi Taifa, Lennox Hines, we all signed amicus briefs to that, you know, it's there. Brother Mario Badelli would also talk about UN resolutions 3103, I forgot exactly, it's from way back, decades back in my mind, but consistently trying to raise the issue of international human rights law being applicable to the United States and used it to call for the release for political prisoners and prisoners of war. And many of them did file these briefs, Jaleel Muntakim and Suliato Okoli, and the list goes on and on. So when you ask me, my brother, about the laws, I don't want to just constrain myself to the type of motions and all that most lawyers usually file in courts, but to bring up some of these novel and innovative rulings that people apply in other countries and require a response and mobilize a movement to be able to do that this year. And I just say one more thing. When we say prisoners of war, what we argue in the legal papers that went to the United States government and all, we're talking about the war that has been waged against black people ever since we were forced to come to this country as kidnapped prisoners of war, which continue with the COINTELPRO, which the U.S. Senate, Nkechi Kaifa didn't say this, it was the U.S. Senate that called it an illegal war, okay, against our people. So,
indeed.
Yeah, so that's what I'm talking about. Struggle continues. What's next?
Oh, okay. Can you tell people what your name means, what Nkechi and Taifa mean, what language they come with? Can you tell people what the name means for identity purposes?
I can't hear you.
You know?
Say it again.
I said, can you tell people what your name means, Nkechi Taifa, for identity purposes? What it means, where it comes from,
what language
it is?
For identity purposes. Yeah, okay, cool. This is a long story. Y'all can read my book to find out how I got my name, but anyway, Nobody gave me my name. I didn't have any ceremony. There was no Florida water sprinkled on me or any reading done. I was 15 years old. I was at this bookstore in D.C. called Drum and Spear Bookstore on Fairmont Street, and I was looking through this book, and I saw this name. I said, Nkechi. Hey, I like the sound of that, and, it meant God's gift. I said, that sounds really good. It wasn't until years later that I found out that name was not supposed to be pronounced Nkechi. I didn't know how to pronounce African names when I was a teenager. It should have been Nkechi. It's a Nigerian name, Igbo name. And, I kind of tried to do the Nkechi thing, but I've been saying Nkechi for so long, it kind of stuck with me. And I would just rationalize it, my brother, by saying, our tongues have been colonized, and anyway, I'm a new African, so I've used my self-determination to pronounce the name the way I'm pronouncing it. But even at that, Buddy Mario always would call me Nkechi, or Nkechi, what did he call me? I forgot, Nkechi, and people call me a lot of things, and it's all good because it's fine. It's all part of the identity. Taifa? Nkechi is from West Africa. Taifa is a Kiswahili name from East Africa. It means nationhood. And so I put that all together, God's gift to the nation, Nkechi Taifa. And again, I talk about this and a little bit more about that, in my upcoming book.
Yes. That's wonderful. Taifa also refers to land. You know what I'm saying? When we say free of the land, it all refers to land as well.
Yep, land, nationhood. Yeah.
From my research.
This is brother named Professor Dr. Ed Onasi. He has a book coming out called Free the Land, and he deals with this issue dealing with names and culture and dress and identity of New Africans. And his book is going to be coming out real soon. And encourage everybody to pick that up. Background information.
We're on it. From my research, I see you did a lot of things in the 80s, right? You did a lot of things in the 80s. Some of the things that I consider notable as a new African myself is that you put out the Code of Umoja in '86. You put out the Code of Umoja, right? The Black Law and Code of Umoja, Constitution, Judicial Statute, and Election Law, right? And divorce law. And you also co-author Reparation Now. You co-founder NCOBA,
you know, you did a lot of things in the 80s, right? Can you tell a little bit more about your experience, you know, that involvement at the Ministry of Justice in the Division of Public Affairs, Africa?
Yeah. Was that the 80s? I don't know, the 70s, 80s? It's kind of it's all blending together.
You know what I'm saying? But the code of Moses, that you orchestrated was in the 80s, you know? I got a copy of it.
Yeah, well,
know,
the original code of Moses was with the founding of the provisional government in 1968, the original code of Moses. And then, you know, as years goes on, I wasn't there, 1968, of course. But as years went on, we added things to it, the election law. We had marriage and divorce. We had passports, the driver's license, all those things that a government, even though subjugated government, provisional government, you know, is supposed to have to provide for its citizens. And in terms of reparations, yes, the book, one of the first books, I guess, to really come out dealing with the issue of reparations, that came out in 1987 originally. It was co-authored by Brother President Mario Badelli, Brother Attorney Chokwe Lumumba, and little old me, myself. And it emanated from a conference that the National Conference of Black Lawyers held at Harvard Law School in 1987, where the question on the table was, did we need a constitutional amendment to effectuate reparations? And the three of us, Brother President Mari, Brother Attorney Chokwe, and myself, agreed that we did not need a constitutional amendment, that everything was already there, the justification in terms of reparatory justice for our people. And our book laid all of that out and talked about, you know, self-determination. It just talked about a whole lot of things. And that really was helped to spur the formation of the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America in COBRA, when Brother Imari, and I must say, the Republic of New Africa Provisional Government always, New African Independence Movement always had the issue of reparations as part of its creed and ideology and part of its work. In the New African Declaration of Independence, it states that we claim no rights from the United States other than those rights belonging to oppressed people wherever they may be in the world. And these include the right to damages, reparations due us for the grievous injuries sustained by ourselves and our ancestors by reason of U.S. lawlessness. Y'all, I got a good ass memory. I mean, God, dang. I haven't said that in a long time. But that's part of the New African Declaration of Independence. So we had always talked about reparations. It was only now at this time that other groups started talking about it outside of the New African Independence Movement as well, such as National Conference of Black Lawyers, which had issued that original call. So even though the provisional government's stance with respect to reparations, just like any entity anywhere in the world, is that reparations usually happens at the end of secession of war, and you go to the negotiating table, and it's either the liberation movement or the new provisional government and the oppressive government, and they come together and they determine what the amends are going to be. Well, Brother Mari Chokwe and all kind of abandoned that in favor of broadening the issue, because everybody wasn't feeling New Africa, everybody wasn't feeling 5 states, everybody wasn't feeling independence movement, you know. And so to see where our people were at that time, we said, okay, we will be help to form this broad-based mass movement, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, as an entity to go out and spread public education, a more mainstream issue, primarily, again, against Black amongst Black organizations, professional Black organizations, fraternities, sororities, churches, unions, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And COBRA did and is doing an excellent job along those ways. But we should really never forget that. Yeah, it really is a function of the liberation movement, who has won and then is able to get reparation. So that was in COBRA. Let me see. We talked about in COBRA. What else you want to talk about the 80s? I don't remember. The elections. Let me just say something about the elections. Okay. I talk about all this in my book. I'm going to be my own tooting on the horn, Black Power, Black Glory, My Audacious Quest for Justice. That's the book. But I talk about all that because it wasn't all sweet and honey and, you know, wine and all like that. You know, there were challenges and issues. This was the height of the COINTELPRO. And you never know how much stuff was stoked by COINTELPRO or how much stuff was, you know, on every organization, every entity goes through issues and problems. I'm just so very blessed. I'm just so, I don't know what the word is, you know, that the U.S. independence movement was able to rise above the COINTELPRO, was able to rise above the disagreements and the issues that there were. I write about all of this in my book, and I write about it because for people today, people in Black Lives Matter, Movement for Black Lives, and a Law for Black Lives and all like that, they need to know what happened in the past so they don't repeat the same mistakes. But we were able, with all of the disagreements and dissensions and false information going around COINTELPRO, to rise above all that and still come out as a united movement, a new African independence movement. And the elections had a whole lot to do with it because some folk were in favor of the elections and some folk were not in favor of the elections. Some folks felt, well, yeah, it's time for a government. Other folks said, no, it's premature. This is not the time to be out front as a government, provision of government. But again, we worked through all of those issues, and as you see, provision of government is still existing today. The New African Independence Movement has spawned down through the generations, other movements have sprouted up. And here you are with George Jackson Radio, okay? You know, we're talking about the next generation.
Oh, okay. I had one question, right? You know, in regards to reparation, from a New App perspective, will reparation be more of the aspect of, like, land, or would it be a resource thing? Would it be more of a land? Would land be more of a reparation than money? What's your take on that?
So one of the things we were doing with the Republic of New Africa back in the day, we talked about having a plebiscite, a people's vote to determine just what we wanted our future to be, self-determination, whether we wanted to go back to Africa. We've been cruelly kidnapped here, A, B, C, D, E, F, or whatever. Whether we wanted to go somewhere else, like the islands or whatever, we've been fragmented all throughout the diaspora. Whether we wanted to join the new white nation that was coming up here on these soils of the American nation and strive to make a multiracial democracy real, or whether we wanted to establish an independent Black nation state right here on this soil, since we were brought here unjustly, we built in the land, we shed our blood here, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So the plebiscite was to determine all of those things. And part of a plebiscite also is, what is the amend? What is the justice that we seek as a result of the war which has been waged against us? It's, to me, it's not something that any one person would decide, but something that we would decide as a nation of people. Is it land? Is it repatriation resources? Is it economic development? Is it scholarship? Is it all of those things? Is it none of those things? Is it change of policies and practices? Is it monuments and museums and all that? My personal position is, well, first of all, this is something that we should decide collectively as a nation, but I believe in individual and collective reparations. First of all, no amount, as the organization I'm with now, NARC, National African American Reparations Commission, says that there's no amount of monetary compensation that can compensate us for the terror and the trauma and the genocide that we have been through. No amount. However, that does not mean, in my humble opinion, that there should not be a negotiated settlement of some amount. I feel that there should be. But there should also be land. Land is the basis of freedom, of independence. Malcolm X said it. Every Mario Badelli said it. Chokwe, the Queen Mother Moore said it. You know, every, like, consistently throughout history, land is the basis. So that is really very high up on the list. But there are other things as well. There could be ameliorative legislation. There's issues dealing with housing. And when we're looking at this situation now with this quote-unquote pandemic, and we see all the money that's being thrown in terms of the quote-unquote rebuilding or the, you know, all of that stuff, that should never be come out of anyone's mind that there's not resources or money. Where there's a will, there's a way. We just need to make sure we keep the demand front and center.
True indeed, true indeed. You know, I'd like to ask you, you know, about it being Women History Month. Can you tell about some of the women in history that inspired you and motivate you to do the work that you do and shape and mold you be the person you are today?
Oh, you know, man, the list is endless. God dang, the list is endless. I will say there are four women, there are ancestors I dedicated my book to. It's four brothers and four sisters. I'll say who those four sisters are. They're not just people in history like we all saw Harriet Tubman and, you know, Queen Nzinga. No, these are people that I walked in their midst. These are people, these are women that inspired me, who taught me. These were women who grounded me, and they're now want them to know that through me, hopefully I vow to make sure that the struggle continues. So those women were first and foremost, again, people that I walked with, Queen Mother Audley Moore, Queen Mother who, you know, back in the Garvey days was talking about all the things that she's talking about, Queen Mother who, oh, gosh, you should just hear her speak. Oh, my gosh. She's, I just can't even, yeah. So Queen Mother Moore, you know, she talked about in reparations from up until the day of her death. Queen Mother Moore, who was chartered as the Minister of Health and Welfare of the Provisional Government of Republic of New Africa at its 1968 founding convention. Queen Mother Moore, who, you know, worked with the Nation of Islam as well, you know, just about every single movement out there. Her Ethiopian Women's Association petitioned the UN with genocide, you know, even long before some of the other more popular ones like W.E.B. Du Bois and William Patterson and them in 51 with their treatise, We Charge Genocide. So Queen Mother Moore, first and foremost. Next, Dr. Frances Cress Wilson. My God, what can we say about Frances? A woman before her time. When I first read the Cress Theory of Color Confrontation and Racism back in the 70s, oh, my goodness, my mind was just set on fire. We're talking a brilliant black woman up until her last days. And her legacy lives on. There's a new book out, Brother Ray Wimbush and Sister Denise Wright wrote, the Osiris paper. So Dr. Frances Cress Wilson, and she also inspired a presentation that I do called, God, what is New Jim Crow or Newfangled Genocide, the Taifa Theory of Mass Incarceration and Racism. So I modeled my title off of her Cress Theory book. The third woman, most of you, probably no one on this call has probably heard of her, Dr. Jean Sindab. Jean, she was the head of an organization I worked for while I was in law school. It was called the Washington Office on Africa. And this was during the early 80s, during the time when all of Southern Africa was under colonial rule and apartheid and the like. And we worked to lobby Congress in terms of those issues. She was just a badass sister, Dr. Jean Sindab, and she has passed on. I write about all of these women in my book. And the fourth one is who I call my sister warrior, Safia Bukhari. Safia Bukhari, we talk about a sister who stood up in court in 1975 in Goochland, Virginia, along with her co-defendant, Brother Messiah Ehehosi. And she said, "You cannot try me in your courts of law because I'm a citizen of the Republic of New Africa. I'm a prisoner of war." I said, "Damn, that sister is bad." That was Sister Safia Bukhari. After she got out of prison, she became one of the chief architects of the Jericho March for Political Prisoners and Prisoners of War, historic march that happened on the steps of the White House with so many historic leaders calling for the release of our brothers and sisters from unjust incarceration. And Safia has also passed on Sister, I want to say Sister, well, she's my sister too, Laura Whitehorn, who actually was my former client in the resistance conspiracy, also known as the Capitol bombing case from the late 80s. But Laura wrote, put together, compiled all of Safia Bukhari's writings into a memoir for Safia called The War Before. And she talks about her life with the Black Panther Party and, you know, the Black Liberation Army, her time in prison, the Jericho March, and all like that. So it's those four women, Queen Mother Moore, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, Dr. Jean Sendeb, and Sister Warrior Safia Bukhari, I would say, are the heroes I'm lifting up right now during Black History. I mean, okay, whatever. Black History Month, Women's History Month, it all should be 365 days a year.
True indeed. Well, I like to tell you, Bob Messiah, so he sent me a peace and blessing your way, too, because I talked to him earlier, right?
Yeah, my brother. In fact, Brother Mari would always, I love the way Brother Mari would always say his name. He was saying, you know, we New Africans, we're not just New Africans. We do this rhythm, and he would say, Messiah. That's what Brother Mari would always say. I said, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. So, in regards to your memoir, right? When should we be looking at
it? Say it one more time. I said,
in regards to your memoir, when should we be looking to receive your memoir?
All right. Well, if folks go to www.blackpowerblacklawyer.com and sign up for the mailing list, I'll keep you apprised of when it's going to be out. Pre-sales is going to probably be starting in about a month. And it'll be out as soon as we're able to get it out after that. But going in, you know, get the pre-sales in. This is special on pre-sales. You'll see that on the website. Website is forthcoming, but there's a landing page there now so you can sign up. So, again, Black Power, Black Lawyer, My Audacious War Justice. And I will say, my brother, it's not just a memoir. It's part memoir. It's part textbook. It's part study guide. And it's part expose. Is not a, I don't know what you would call it, but it, you know, it's funny, it's serious, you know, it has history, it has culture, it has romance, it has scandal. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there, right? Black Power, Black Lawyer. So anybody interested in hearing about that period of time on up till the present from the first-hand front seat point of view of someone who lived through it all, you know, check it out.
Okay. You know what I'm saying? On another note, right, you know, I understand that you was a teacher at one time, you wrote children books, right? Can you tell me about your experience as a teacher and writing children books? Can you tell me about those experiences?
Sure. So, man, dang, I must be old. But when I was in my early 20s, right after undergrad, I taught in independent Black school, Watoto School, Nation House Watoto, and we developed a lot of our own materials, okay? And so during that time, I developed materials which ended up becoming two books for young people. One was called Shining Legacy, Story Points and Tales for the Young, so Black Heroes will be sung, and The Adventures of Kojo and Amma. And Shining Legacy celebrated 12 Black heroes and heroines, ranging from Josephine Q, to Demar Beasy, to Paul Robeson, and my brain is going dead right now, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, the list goes on. And the teaching style that I would use, well, you know, it's kind of like rap today, I guess. But back in the day, you know, they were called them story poems. So they were told the story of these icons, these legendary heroes, and I accentuated them with rhyme. And then The Adventures of Kojo and Amma was for a much younger age children just beginning to learn to read, and it had a number of different stories in there that followed a little boy and girl. His name was Kofi, her name was Ama, Kojo and Ama, something like that. And they had the black cat, Sheba, you know, saved them through many adventures from City Park to the island of Jamaica to land in the south. There's a whole story in there about save the land, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So those were the books, and they're out of print right now, but as soon as my memoir hits the scenes, I'm going to be re-upping those and putting those out, because someone even just called me today. They're doing all this homeschooling now as a result of everybody being home and saying, Nikishi, where are your books? Hold on. Wait a minute. Okay, say, Nikishi, where are your books? And I say, they're coming. So these were books I called, they're classics, because Shawnee Legacy was written in 1982, and The Adventures of Kojo and Ama was published in 1993. So those are those books as well. And then there was Reparations, yes, and loads of articles and white papers and book chapters and all like that dealing with the justice system that's out there. Anybody just Googles my name, stuff pops up.
True indeed. I want to thank you again for coming to our broadcast and sharing knowledge to understand. I'd like to thank you for all the work you did in the past, the work you did in the present, the work you're going to do in the future. I know you said you'll be on an hour, so we got like 4 minutes left of your time. Could you share a couple of, can you give a final thoughts and final words to the listeners?
Well, it's interesting. Final word. I have the TV on right now down low, and for some reason there's three words on there. I don't know what show this is, but it says, lest we forget. Lest we forget. So let me just make that my closing theme. We must never forget who came before us, okay? We must never forget our ancestors. We must never forget people who walked in our midst that we learned from. We do their names and their deeds need to live on. It always makes me so upset when people talk about the civil rights movement, or even when they talk about the Black Power movement, they never talk about the New African Independence Movement. That's what my book does. It talks about the New African Independence Movement, a movement that is almost often forgotten in history. The Black Power movement was not just the Black Panther Party and Stokely Carmichael Carl and Black Power. It was where people were striving for land and independence right here in this country on this soil, buttressed by international law. And people need to know about the architects of that philosophy. And the main architects, the main three architects, I would say, is Queen Mother Audley Moore, Imari Abubakar Yobadeli, and Chokwe Lumumba, who became, as we know later, mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, and his son is following in his footsteps. We must never forget, lest we forget, we must never forget those who struggle for us. We get arrested in front of the South African embassy, striving for freedom for Nelson Mandela and independent South Africa, but we don't do the same thing for our freedom fighters who struggle for us, who answered the call that something be done about all this madness that's going on over here. Asada Shakur can't come back to this country because we have not struggled enough for her. Suniata Okoli, 83 years old, cannot get out of prison because we have not struggled enough for him. Matulu Shakur should have been out of prison, okay? Leonard Peltier, Maroon, Schultz, Bronze Bowser, the list goes on. So lest we forget, we must never, ever forget. And the next generation that's coming up now needs to follow in your footsteps, my brother, and make sure that we keep this history alive. That's it. Free the land.
True indeed. By any means necessary.
Yes, indeed.
To independence now. Tomorrow. The United States of Africa.
Yeah, they say those who do not move do not feel their chains, but the African people aware of their pain, aware of the game, invader deception, black presidents who are white man extensions, people from Cape to Cairo rebel, cause fake independence and ongoing hell, colonial ties still keep them chained, the richest continents getting robbed again, the IMF and World Bank criminal schemes, what about reparations? To me it seems that every metropole from Amsterdam to Paris and Brussels was built with the hands of African labor, a slave relation, developing Europe at expense of their nation. But Africans rebel from the first conquest till flag independence at last accomplished.
Il y en a qui demandent de tout l'impérialisme. L'impérialisme, regardez dans vos assiettes quand vous mangez les grains de riz, de maïs, de mil importés. C'est ça l'impérialisme. N'allez pas plus loin.
Yeah. Hey yo, the spirit of Lumumba lives on in Congo, like Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso. Samora Michelle, it was Viva Frelimo, but Mozambique still fighting for freedom. Why did these three who dare to invent the future then clash to the fullest extent with the colonizers? If we open eyes, if we can see the rich whites, we're scared of rising African power, real independence, a people's politics, anti-capitalism. So they stifle their growth in every way, so that South Africa looks colonized today. For any flaws of Mugabe, that ain't what they hate. Zimbabwe's not a colony, make no mistake. Look at AFRICOM, the African command. That's the US and a puppet shaking each other's hands. Divide and conquer is a hell of a tactic. They blame Africa for relations that backward. The whole basis was plunder from outside Rwanda, Uganda. The Sudan's divides, pushing forward war for precious coal sand. So cell phones and PCs are sold in lands where people don't know how they were constructed. Your Windows now functions from a child's destruction.